Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:30 on April 12th. With us, we have Representatives Thompson, Sadler, Johnson, Olson, and Holmes. We do have a quorum to conduct business. There's going to be a change in the calendar today. We're going to hear House Bill 266 first because it's only going to take a few minutes. And then it will be followed by Senate Bill 27 and Senate Bill 119. So, come on up, Chris.
Completely in notice.
Yes.
Perfect. This is a new CS.
During the last meeting, we have on this bill, make sure I'm on the right bill. Yeah, we put a number of hours and gone through many versions of the bill. We have before us today the will be the final version of this bill, and it's version Y. And I'd entertain a motion to adopt version Y for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move we adopt House Bill 266, designated 27LS1110/Y.
I'll object for discussion. I don't think I have it. I don't have any of the...
Well, then I will object because I do have it.
There you go.
For purposes of discussion.
Representative.
Thanks.
Conrad, do you want to walk us through the minor changes? I think there's room for two there, isn't there?
Go to custom to your face.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Representative Olson and the committee. If you give me just 1 second to sort a couple of things out. The version that the committee has before it is actually, I believe, the initial version of the bill. And I've got to dig down to the bottom of my pile. We have had a number of draft CSs that have gone around and around and around, and it's going to take me just a minute. Chris, the version M, I did see that in here. M was the original version before us. The current version that we're talking about now is the draft CS version Y. Draft CS version Y makes a number of changes from that original bill, and I've got to actually find my copy of version Y. Can I steal that one from you? Thank you.
On Lindsay Holmes.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Conrad.
Sorry, I'm looking at the same page.
We're back on the record. Mr. Jackson, please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Conrad Jackson, staff to the committee and to Representative Olson. The CS before you, version Y, is a change from the original bill, version M. People may not even remember it that far back. It's been over a month now. To go into a little bit of history and the reasoning behind version Y, on day one of the first hearing of this bill, we were told by the sponsor and by C.W. Jasper, the representative from the naturopaths, they were concerned about erosion of their scope of practice and not interested in an expansion, just protecting their current scope of practice.
Mr. Jackson, give you a promotion. I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representative Guerra. Would you like to take a seat or just stand or sit at the table?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I was saying, that the intent was to not expand the scope of practice, but to avoid erosion of the scope of practice. There were apparently efforts beginning in the department to make some changes to current regulations regarding naturopaths. The attempt was to move regulation directly into statute. There were a number of iterations through a lot of work with Christopher Clark in Representative Munoz's office, the sponsor of the bill, and cooperation with some representatives from the MDs, from pharmacists, from naturopaths. I think if someone wasn't talked to, it was only because they were out of town. So what we have come to in the final version that you see before you, version Y, is an attempt to be very clear to not expand the scope of practice, not erode the scope of practice, but statutorily lock in the scope of practice for naturopaths in the state of Alaska. From version Y, which was a one-page document that Mr. Clark was kind enough to loan me from his expansive packet on this bill as well, we actually make a change to section 1A, which is on page 1, lines 7 through 10. We reduce that down to a single line of except as provided in B of this section. So naturopaths would then be restricted and not able to give, prescribe, or recommend in their practice a prescription drug except as provided in B of this section. In B of this section, we have added a new section that reads, notwithstanding 1A of this section, a person who practices naturopathy may give, prescribe, or recommend in the practice a device or a homeopathic remedy. It goes on to talk about the status of a drug that a naturopath may give or prescribe, dealing with compounding. And then there's another section, D, on page the beginning of page 2, line 5, that deals with Medicaid reimbursement. Also, in section 3 of the new CS version Y, we are amending Title 8, 45060, by adding in a new 8, which reads, as has procured, sold, prescribed, or dispensed drugs in violation of law, regardless of whether there has been a criminal action. This is a section that deals with grounds for suspension, revocation, or refusal to issue a license for a naturopath. Beyond that, we insert there's an amendment to in section 4 of the bill that amends 0845-203 that gets into the definitions of naturopathy, and naturopathy meaning the use of hydrotherapy, a dietetic remedy, an herbal remedy, or a homeopathic remedy. The bill also deletes from that section of statute some of the definition or the meaning of dietetics, which are include herbal and homeopathic remedies. We're covering that in the earlier in the section. We're also adding a new paragraph with some definitions of dietetic remedy, herbal remedy, homeopathic remedy, and hydrotherapy. Section 6 of the new CS deals with Title 47, again dealing with Medicaid reimbursement, and Section 7 creates an immediate effective date. Again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the attempt was to define the scope of practice very clearly, to give the department very clear guidelines for their promulgation, excuse me, of regulation, to give pharmacists a clear definition of what they may or may not fill for naturopathic patients, and just provide clarity all around.
Any questions for Conrad or Chris? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Conrad, Mr. Jackson, looking on page 3, line 18, I'm sorry, could you explain to me the department may not offer services for prescribed drugs given or prescribed, I'm trying to flip back the references, could you just put that in English for me? Let me know, department, what services?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that is language that Ledge Legal has put in, again, in the attempt to make sure that naturopathic doctors are not eligible for Medicaid reimbursement. That may or may not be necessary at this point, since we are really not expanding their prescriptive scope of practice. We are maintaining it. I guess if a person was to get very technical, which I guess you all do in this building, there is a minor expansion of scope of practice because we are allowing prescriptions of homeopathic remedies, such as you heard in the first committee hearing, capsicum, other products such as that, other medicines that are of prescription strength that is opened up. So this language was to, it was part of that section you see on page 2, line 5 through 7.
Any further questions? Well, I will remove my objection. Chris.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And thank you for the work that has been put into this bill. I think the record needs to reflect that there was not support for version Y, and that indeed the statement that it represents an expansion of scope of practice with homeopathic remedy, I think you would find there would be some agreement to disagree with that remark. Furthermore, the language in here would not allow for the sterile versions of B12 and vitamin C and other B-complex vitamins that naturopaths would give in injectable form to some of their clients. So the argument could be made that this version Y represents a diminishment or reduction of scope of practice, and I just want to make sure the record was clear on that.
Well, I think in the course of working on this bill, we found that there were a number of instances and cases and actually action that has been taken as a result of what the naturopaths were doing was not in regs, and they had expanded, and what they, and even though they've been doing it for years and years and years, they were practicing outside of the scope of their what they could do. And what we did is on the record a number of times we've asked that we bring into regulation what we or bring the regs into alignment with the statutes, and that's what version Y does. And it does take away some things that they have been doing, but not necessarily doing because they were authorized to, but doing it because they thought they could, or possibly thought they could get away with it. And there have been several active investigations that have found numerous instances where naturopaths were well outside of their authority, and including injectables that were Schedule I and Schedule II drugs, things that using out-of-state prescription pads. But all we're trying to do is get everything in alignment with what they asked for, which was to give them in the regulations what they actually have, or give them in statute what they actually have in the regulations, not what they have been doing. And that's where the difference comes from. But we appreciate all the work that you put into it. And with that, I believe I will lift my objection. Is there any further objection?
I believe Representative Holmes objected.
Oh, did I?
No, you didn't have your packet. You were going to read the packet. So I did it.
Okay. Yeah, she started to, but she didn't have a copy, so he did.
Yeah.
Okay.
What are the wishes of the committee?
On this bill. Mr. Chairman, if I might, I move that the CS for House Bill 266, version 27-LS1110/Y, be advanced from committee.
Same
with office. With attached fiscal notes and zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Brief of these.
Mr. Chairman, I will rescind my motion to advance this from committee at this time. And
Don Hebbiger, please join us.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Don Hebbiger, Director of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing.
I've got a question.
Yes, sir.
Does this bill meet the stated intent of bringing the regulations that are currently on the books into conformance with statutes and not expanding the scope of practice? It's kind of a loaded question. But
Mr. Chairman, we believe that the statute clearly says there's no prescriptive authority. Quite a while ago, regulations were written that have been interpreted by the department over time to be no prescriptive authority. We referred early on to the Reardon letter that kind of used that as our foundation for today, and I believe Y is compliant with the division's interpretation of statute and regulations that currently exists.
Any further questions for Don?
That's what I needed to hear.
Thank you very much. We also have John Sherwood in the room for questions, if we need John. No? Okay, with that, I'm going to set aside the bill, and we're going to move on to, or take a brief of these.
No, you're on.
We're on. Been a long week.
Don't hit again.
No, you're done. Yeah. He just likes the gavel. We're back in order.
I thought you were tap dancing around. Yeah.
I wanted to see Sam dance.
Yeah. No.
Just joking there. It'll mean nothing to anybody outside the room. So, do you want to give us just a real brief summary of the bill, and then we'll get on to a number of people who want to testify?
Sure thing. For the record, Sam Gottstein, staff to Senator Willikowski. I gave a brief overview yesterday. I was just going to run through a few quick questions that came up. I also want to apologize. Senator Willikowski is on the floor, so or else he would be here. To start off, just to clarify some of the statements that were made about the EPA voluntary phase-out, as of right now, it's my understanding that they are it's a proposed voluntary phase-out for U.S. manufacturers to be done at the end of 2013, which is before the effective date of the version ECHO. With that said, this voluntary phase-out does not have anything to do with imports. So even though U.S. manufacturers may be complying with this voluntary phase-out, we could still be importing these toxic chemicals with a number of known health effects into Alaska. There were a lot of questions about definitions. Although version E is a committee substitute, and I'm probably not the best person to speak to the changes, it seems that the intent is to protect Alaskan retailers with this CS. And this bill is friendly to Alaska businesses and protects Alaskan retailers, especially with version E that's before you. Senate Bill 27 does do a couple of things that should allay some of the committee's potential concerns. First, we have a delayed effective date. The effective date doesn't come in until 2014. The bill also exempts used products, anything that we have or might be sold in a thrift store. And it also would apply to products that were brought into Alaska before the effective date. So a local retailer or even a manufacturer distributor could be bringing in these products up until December 31st, I believe, 2013, and then could sell those products later without having the bill apply to it. Because of this, it gives retailers an ample time to shift to products that are safe, to give us safe homes and healthy families, especially given 12 other states that have done these bans, the European Union, and large companies like Walmart. In terms of definitions of distributors and retailers, I were to go to Costco, for example, I would be buying something from Costco. That's them acting as a retailer. It would not apply to this legislation as it's currently written. Mattress Ranch also, I forgot to bring it with me, but I looked on their website and saw a bunch of brand names, and it's maybe a little bit more than half a dozen, maybe close to 10 brand names. Each of the brands have different styles of mattresses, and so I would consider those to be the manufacturers, and then the Mattress Ranch would be the retailer in that sense. For more questions on the definitions, I believe Terry Bannister with Legislative Legal, who helped draft this bill, should be online. It's also, I think, the more important question is just to make sure that Alaskan businesses are not going to be punished or penalized through this legislation. And I believe Kristen Ryan with the Department of Environmental Conservation is online, who can answer some of those questions and talk about enforcement. But my guess is that she would say that using fines is a last resort. I think there are similar pieces of legislation that have been passed I'm not entirely sure all the details. Kristen would probably know more about that. But she has said before that the fines are really not used. So with that, I guess I'm here for questions.
Is there anybody in the room that would care to add anything? Nobody signed up. Anybody got any questions for Sam? Thanks again, Sam.
Sam, you mentioned that Walmart has done this voluntarily. Do you know their position on this piece of legislation?
For the record. Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I'm not a representative of Walmart. I think in previous hearings on the bill, there have been people who've worked with Walmart to try to make sure that their products are PBDE free. All I know is that this previous summer, Walmart has done enhanced testing procedures to make sure that none of their products have PBDEs, and have broadcast it loud and clear to their suppliers that they won't be accepting it. I can look through and try to get you more specifics if you like, but that's my recollection.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm not sure if we have a letter from Walmart, but in the past they have sent a letter of opposition to this, and I don't know if we still have it in this bill or not. And my point is they're doing it voluntarily. But I think we had a Walmart letter. It may have been last year's bill. But their opposition was that they're doing it voluntarily, and it's a much smoother business transaction for them to do it that way than it is to have it mandated. So, and if I'm not speaking for Walmart, I'm sure they will call. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We're going to go out of the building. First one signed up today was Jeff Tucker. Are you with us, Jeff?
I am, Representative Olson. And thank you for letting me testify. My name is Jeff Tucker. I'm the fire chief for the North Star Volunteer Fire Department, and I am also the immediate past president of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. And I am calling in today to support the CS Senate Bill 27. The Alaska Fire Chiefs Association supports the phase-out of PBDs due to the concerns about the health risks associated with exposure. We believe this bill is a step in the right direction for improving the health and safety of our firefighters in the community. Protecting firefighters and building occupants from fire is critical, but we can achieve this without exposing ourselves to this particular class of toxic chemicals. Unlike other flame retardants, when PBDs burn, they release dense fumes that reduce visibility and produce a highly corrosive gas known as hydrogen bromide. We support the use of flame retardants. There are alternatives that do not contain bromine and are safer for firefighters than PBDs. With all this in mind, I would encourage the members of the committee to pass the CSSB 27. And thank you.
Thanks a lot. Jeff, any questions for Chief Tucker? Kristen Ryan, your name's come up several times today. Who wants first shot at Kristen? Are you with us, Kristen?
I am, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
I guess your thoughts on the CSS before us.
Okay, for the record, my name is Kristen Ryan. I'm the director for the Division of Environmental Health, and I guess would be implementing this legislation if it's passed. I think just commenting on Sam's response in the beginning, civil fines are a tool in our toolbox of enforcement. We have several regulatory programs that already have civil fine authority, and it is a rare tool. It's only a last resort typically used when we aren't getting compliance through voluntary means. And I think the discussion has already been clarified that a retailer in our mind is somebody selling directly to a consumer, whereas a distributor is somebody who is selling to either another distributor or a retailer. So this legislation seems to target, as the current version is drafted, manufacturers and distributors, which would be most likely out-of-state companies. I was on a teleconference this morning with my counterparts in all the other states, and Oregon and Washington do have similar pieces of legislation that they're implementing, so we do have lots of, I guess, a pathway of how we would implement it in Alaska, looking to our sister states. We also have, in the fish tissue testing program, which is done at the Environmental Health Laboratory, we have over 500 samples of fish that we have collected throughout the state of Alaska and tested for polybromated diphenyl ethers. And we are finding them at various levels throughout the state of Alaska. Not only is there deposition, which you've heard about from sources outside of the state of Alaska, but the most likely source of the PBDs in Alaska are from our homes, and the discharges from our homes into our environment through septic systems and the wastewater treatment plants, which do not remove this chemical. So that's, we are the, so if our environment has it in Alaska, that means our homes have it, because that's the likeliest source, because it's in our home products. So I guess we have some evidence that we're starting to see it in our fish. I have not done a lot of research into the human exposure element, but that would fall to a different department's authority anyway. So just wanted to inform the committee that our fish tissue testing program, which is looking at mercury and other contaminants of a health concern, are starting to find PBDEs as well. Are there any questions from the committee?
Oh, several. Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Can you please explain to me your statement that it's getting into this in through the septic system? Is that from people that have been contaminated with it? I mean, are we flushing mattresses down the toilet? Baby clothes? I mean, help me understand that. I don't see a linkage, and I would like some scientific backup for that statement as to where that stuff came from, if there is any.
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I can provide you some follow-up material that shows you that pathway. But it's pretty well documented that the flame retardants exist in our personal products that we have in our homes. They're in our TVs and our computers and our couches. And the dust, the polymer does not bind with the product it's been applied to. So it falls out as dust onto the floor and is consumed by us as we touch these things in our homes and pass through our bodies. And then that therefore ending up in our sewage outfalls. The other pathway is through the washing of our clothes. The flame retardants this bill is targeting, the polybromated diphenyl ethers, are not added to clothing. I think that question came up yesterday. That's not how it's getting into our clothes. It's getting into our clothes from these other products in our homes that have been that do contain the product. So it's a dust that falls out of our home products that is then cleaned through our process of cleaning our going to the bathroom, and then it's going out into our environment.
Kit,
Mr. Chair.
Follow. Can you give me a listing, and you don't have to do it now, where the 500 samples from around the state came from?
I can, sir.
And just a broad question. Species? Were they salmon, trout?
Mr. Chairman, or I'm sorry, Representative, through the chair, it's a variety of species, Arctic char, salmon, small fry. I think the most disturbing aspect of this data that we've gotten so far, and we've been just randomly doing this for the last couple of years, is that fry, the small fish, seem to have the highest levels rather than the large fish, and that's maybe a body mass issue, but we have sampled a large variety of species. It's the whole gamut of species you would find in Alaska, and I can provide that to you in writing.
And also, if I could, Mr. Chairman, could you provide the number of that 500 as a percentage that actually had some contamination?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'll give you all our data.
Yeah, because I think your statement was you found some.
Yes, we're finding it at various levels, depending on the fish, how old they are, and where we collected the sample. Some places have higher levels than others.
That's the information I'd like to have.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Kristen, what's your feeling on the EPA and what the direction they're going in?
Mr. Chairman, I think EPA is trying to ban flame retardants as best they can. I think they, like a lot of people in this field, have decided that they are dangerous to public health and they're persistent in our environment. Unfortunately, the Environmental Protection Agency, it actually does not have adequate authority, in my opinion, to deal with chemicals in personal products. So therefore, they are unable to ban them, even though they have published as of last week something in the Federal Register describing their concerns about flame retardants and the risks. But they have actually banned new uses of flame retardants. I do have the authority to ban new uses just last week is what I'm referring to, but they are unable to restrict the use of chemicals already in commerce. And the voluntary measures that Sam referred to are related to agreements they've made with local manufacturers in the United States to stop producing these chemicals and use an alternative. So that is proceeding, but the majority of our products that use these flame retardants don't come from the United States. So I'm not sure that ban will have much of an impact on Alaskans' public health.
Now I've got a loaded question for you. Does this bill go far enough or too far?
Oh, wow, that is loaded. Mr. Chairman, I personally believe that flame retardants are a problem, and at least these polybromated diphenyl ethers they're very similar to thyroid hormones in our bodies, and they mimic them once we're exposed to them, and they're persistent in our environment. So I do think a banning of flame retardants is a good thing. I can say that.
Any further questions for Chris? Representative Thompson.
I've read statements by some doctors that feel like maybe we may be premature, that there are some alternatives out there, but are they effective in retarding flames? Is there enough alternative products that are going to be flame retardants that can protect people and protect especially young children from receiving burns? I mean, are we premature, or are there products out there that are readily available and will be used that aren't a danger? Or are these new products, have they been tested, and are they going to have problems in a few years?
Representative Thompson, through the chair, that is a concern. This bill does give the department the authority to evaluate other flame retardants and assess their risks. So I guess the bill sort of gets to that second question you have. It gives us the ability to consider risks of alternatives. For your first question, there are alternatives out there, and as Sam has said and I'm familiar with, there are several states that have banned PBDEs, and those companies are using safer alternatives. And finally, I would note that the PBDEs, from what I've read, give you about 11 more seconds. If you're on a bed that's on fire and you're on a mattress that has PBDEs, you're going to get 11 more seconds before it goes into flames versus a product that perhaps does not have the flame retardant. So I'm not sure 11 seconds is worth the risk we're seeing from these chemicals persisting in our environment. And also, products are being made in ways that are safer now. Cigarettes no longer continue to burn if they haven't been inhaled upon because they've put chemicals in cigarettes that make them go out. Candles go out when they tip over now. So there's been a lot of improvements in fire safety in our world over the last 20 years that I think make it not maybe as necessary to have these chemicals. But there are alternatives out there that have been found to be safer, yes.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you. And just to clarify, when you said the 11 seconds, that would be compared to not using any other type of alternative fire safety. We're not advocating not using any fire safety. That would be the PBDs would give you the 11 seconds compared to a mattress that had no other precautions taken, as opposed to something without with a different form of protection, flame retardant.
Yes, thank you. That's correct.
Just wanted to be clear that we weren't advocating giving up the 11 seconds. We're advocating using a different type of flame retardant to slow the flame. I just wanted to be clear that
11 seconds is a long time.
I know. That's why I wanted to clarify that statement.
Kristen, from the looks around the table, when you mentioned the 11 seconds, I think everybody, including us old guys, figured that 11 seconds we could get off the bed and possibly out of the bedroom, hopefully. But any further questions for Kristen? Thanks again, and sorry we couldn't get to you and everybody else yesterday. David Heimbach, are you with us?
I am, sir.
Oh, please speak your name and affiliation.
Thank you for letting me speak. I'm just turning down my speaker here in a second. Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I'm Dr. David Heimbach. I have for 35 years been the director of the University of Washington Burn Center. And for the last 35 years, we have taken care of almost all of the major burns in Alaska. And for the last 10 years, we've taken care of all of them as the burn units up there have closed. I have been the president of the American Burn Association. I've been president of the International Society for Burn Injury. And I've gotten numerous awards for work in developing countries regarding burn and fire safety. I would like to make just three points. Point number one is that there is no question in my mind that fire retardants do give people more time to escape fires. The problem with burns, and we take care of approximately 900 of them per year. By the way, I'm not speaking for the Burn Center. I'm speaking for myself, or the University of Washington. About a third of my 900 patients are children. The vast majority of the children are covered insurance-wise by Medicaid, and that would be Alaskan Medicaid, of course, in your circumstance. The other people that are at risk and need that 11 seconds, and I think it's actually more than 11 seconds, the people that need 11 seconds are also elderly people. And they're also at risk of not being able to put out of a fire as quickly. It costs approximately, in my ICU, approximately $6,000 per day. So a child with a 40% burn who stays in the hospital a day and a half to 2 days per percent burn would be in there for 80 days or cost almost $500,000. That, in terms of expenses to the state, is substantial. If you multiply that by 10 patients or more, and since we have 300, I would anticipate there'd be at least that many as a result of fire retardants. So I think you want to be careful at what you're banning and what the consequences of it are versus the risks. The second point I wanted to make is going to be made by Professor Gordon Nelson, who's going to talk about the safety issues. We have no problem with the polybromides being removed because they're being voluntarily removed anyway. And there are good substitutes in terms of TC, PP, and TDCP, which are the TRIS things in those. So I'm not going to talk about that. I would just like to mention one more thing about the firefighters. Firefighters are are concerned about inhaling fire retardants. I would point out to the firefighters, and there are many firefighters who agree with me, that pure pine smoke in and of itself contains 250 known toxic chemicals. Plastics, you can triple that, about 700 known toxic chemicals. So the addition of small amounts of these newer products basically doesn't add anything to the risk of fire smoke inhalation. And I studied smoke inhalation all of my medical career. So with that, I speak that I think we want to be careful about banning the products that have been shown to be safe. We're already getting rid of the ones that have been shown to be mutagenic. And, of course, the both the EU, European Union, as well as the EPA in Canada and the United States have declared that these newer ones are without risk to humans. So I would certainly answer any questions and appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you. I'm just a little confused as to whether it's testifying for or against the bill. It sounded, I heard that there are good substitutions, and I'm a little confused. Was that in support?
I'm sorry. Are you speaking to me?
Yeah. Is this? I'm just confused. Are you? You're supporting? Are you?
Are you speaking to me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is this? I'm confused. You're supporting? Are you?
I'm not supporting the bill.
Okay. Well, then I'm a little confused, Mr. Chairman, because I heard that there are good substitutes out there and that...
Well, I think that you'll find that there are not good substitutes out there that have been studied anywhere... that have been studied anywhere nearly as much as the ones that are currently there. But we don't know. You're going to have to watch these for 10 years or 15 years before they get into the food chain as well as into the environment. And we don't know about them causing cancer over the long haul. So we know about these. We don't know about new ones. And as far as I know, there are children's sleepwear, for example, now is tighter, so it doesn't require flame retardants to be in it, and that, the concern of that in 1972 is that children with an older form of TRIS used to lick their clothes, and if you lick them, you got some into their body, and that was they were found to be a mutagenic. But now the clothes are better, so that's true. We have a substitute in children's sleepwear, but we don't have a chemical substitute for anything that that resembles the safety of these others. But I would like Professor Gordon Nelson to speak to that.
Yeah, he'll be coming up shortly. Any further questions for Dr. Heimbach? Thanks again, Doctor. Stephen Rubright?
Yes.
Please state your name and affiliation, and thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. My name's Steve Rubright. I'm just a voter that lives in Anchorage and been following this issue on Senate Bill 27. I used to work up on the slope as in safety up there, and I've been listening to yesterday and today online. Had a firefighter friend tell me that you guys were going to be on, and kind of what I've heard from the people trying to pass Senate Bill 27 is there's some sort of alternative, but I haven't heard any real numbers as far as what the current effective thing we're using that's saving so many lives. I mean, thousands of lives a year seem to be being saved by our fire retardants, but I haven't really heard numbers attached to the people who are, you know, the toxic effects and things like that. And then the woman who was on a few people ago said that, you know, I haven't really heard any alternatives of actual names being used. And then she said, well, when they come up, you know, if there's a problem, we'll have to study it. And then made the 11 seconds comment. And I think we've all seen the video of the fire in the room and how fast that spreads. 11 seconds is an eternity. And even if it's 2 seconds. And I just think that this is kind of premature, and that I understood, like Mr. Representative Johnson, that in 2013 the federal government was supposed to be working on coming up with a 50-state nationwide approach to this, and I just think that would be a better thing. And just want to let you know I'm a voter that's kind of concerned about it, and I'll listen offline.
Stephen, this version of the bill, we have an effective date of, I believe, 7/1/14. Allow the EPA to promulgate the regulations that they're working on, and then give us adequate time to decide whether or not they're adequate, or whether we need to change. But any questions for Mr. Rubright? Thanks again, Charles Cleaver.
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, please state your name and affiliation, and thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Charles Cleaver, and I live in Anchorage, Alaska. And I don't have any specific affiliation. I am in the construction industry, and I was concerned about this bill, given that we use flame retardant material in our welding clothes and our clothes around the shop and that sort of thing. I do see there's an exemption for that in there, but I'm afraid that how do you specify industrial use for clothing given that there's other uses for it? I'm a little bit concerned that way. And I'm also listening in along the way. A couple of things jumped out at me. And I am against the bill, by the way, but a couple of things jumped out at me. One is someone said, well, we've got a couple years of study on this, and we found some levels, but the levels weren't quantified. I mean, how are they toxic levels? A couple of years of study doesn't seem like it's really due diligence to me. Seems like it's just sort of a, well, I read an article here, and we've got a couple years here, but it certainly doesn't seem like it's really done the due diligence on it that's necessary to make some statements about this material being toxic to the point that we need to get rid of it. And in addition, one thing that really jumped out at me is I'm originally from Oregon, grew up in Oregon. I've lived in Alaska since the 70s, but someone said, well, Oregon has adopted this, and we could follow their procedures on some of this, and I could tell you that we don't want to do that. You follow something that Oregon does, you're going on a slippery slope, because that's a state you don't want to follow on most everything. So I just wanted to throw that out.
Any questions for Mr. Cleaver? Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much for the time.
Pamela Miller, are you with us?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. I'm just here to provide any answers to questions. I've testified on the bill prior, and we're strongly in support for both public health reasons and especially to protect vulnerable populations, including children and firefighters. Thank you, sir.
Do you want to state your affiliation, please, for the record?
Yes, sir. For the record, my name is Pamela Miller, Executive Director and Biologist with Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
Any questions for Ms. Miller? Thanks again, Ms. Miller. Andrew McGuire.
Thank you, Chair, for recognizing me. I'm Andrew McGuire. I'm Executive Director of the Trauma Foundation based at San Francisco General Hospital. and I've been involved in fire and burn prevention for 39 years. I also have led two campaigns in my career. The very first campaign was to get children's pajamas mandated flame resistant up to size 14 as a effort in Massachusetts that then became a federal standard, and that's been referred to earlier. And the standard for children's pajamas took effect in the early 70s, and by 1977, by March of 1977, there were no longer chemicals used in children's pajamas to make them flame resistant. Instead, children's pajamas were made out of motacrylic and polyester and other synthetic fibers with no chemicals, but those synthetic fibers were fire resistant. So I just want to clear up something that I've been hearing, is that there aren't chemicals in clothing, whether it's pajamas, day wear, and so on, unless you purposely go out and buy Nomex or something like that. The second campaign I led, and in fact I testified over the phone in Alaska about 6 years ago regarding this, I led a campaign to mandate that all cigarettes become self-extinguishing or fire safe so that they don't cause the ignition of furniture or mattresses or other products. And I want to clarify one more thing about cigarettes, is that the cigarette companies do not make cigarettes fire safe by adding chemicals. Instead, the cigarette paper is made slightly thicker. It's just slightly thicker paper in a couple of areas on the column, and they self-extinguish because no oxygen can go through the thicker paper. So that is a preface. I want to answer a couple of questions that have been raised. The first is, can make fire-safe mattresses, furniture, and electronics without any chemicals whatsoever?
Yeah, okay.
When it comes to furniture and upholstered furniture and mattresses, the answer is absolutely yes, you can. And in fact, there is a federal draft standard by the Consumer Product Safety Commission, the United States Consumer Product Safety Commission, that many of us believe will be promulgated within the next year or so, that lays out all of the criteria for having the same level of fire safety for furniture that you have right now if there are flame retardants in the foam, but without flame retardants. And it has to do with the having regulations about the weave and thickness of fabric, and with whether or not you can put a synthetic barrier cloth in between the fabric and the foam. And what's the most important thing I'd like to point out today is that when it comes to furniture, the standard that's being followed around the United States and actually North America, all of Canada included, is flame retardants are added to the foam of furniture, not to the fabric. And I think that it's been shown in the peer-reviewed literature that that does not offer fire safety. Whether you want to talk about 11 or 12 seconds, it's totally irrelevant, because the way a fire starts in furniture is that the fabric ignites first. Once the fabric ignites, the flames are large enough to overcome the fire retardant safety factor in the foam. So if you wanted to use flame retardants in furniture to prevent fires, you would put the flame retardants in the fabric, not underneath the fabric, where it's too late once a fire starts in the fabric. So there's no peer-reviewed literature, there's no scientifically published articles about the efficacy and fire safety of chemicals used in furniture. Secondly, chemicals used in the plastic cabinets of TVs and other electronic products, the data doesn't show that there's a fire problem of the cases of TVs igniting. Now, there is a push by the chemical industry to have what they call a flame standard so that a candle can't ignite a plastic case. But that isn't how how TV fires or electronic fires start. They start on the interior with overheating of product inside the TV. And with that, there are other methods to protect for fire safety without adding, whether it's PBDEs or any other fire retardant chemical, to the plastic. So my last point is that there is a phony organization that's been created by the chemical industry called Citizens for Fire Safety. And when Dr. David Heimbach testified in California, the last time I heard him testify, under oath, he stated that his way had been paid to that hearing by the chemical industry. And the same was true of Mr. or Dr. Gordon Nelson. The two of them were the only two outsiders to come into Sacramento, California to testify on a related fire retardant issue. And they both claimed that their way was paid by the chemical industry. And so when someone says what their affiliation is, they should also include that they are actually going around on behalf of the chemical industry. And Citizens for Fire Safety, when you look at their IRS 990 filings for the year 2010, it says their mission is to promote the common business interests of the chemical manufacturing industry, quote unquote. When you read their website, it says that they were founded as a California nonprofit seeking to educate the public on fire practices, fire safe practices within the home, as well as empower those organizations charged with protecting the public safety. This is a phony organization. A similar organization was created by the tobacco industry to fight the Fire Safe Cigarette campaign for 28 years. And the person who is ultimately behind creating the phony organization on behalf of the Tobacco Institute is the same gentleman who worked for the bromine industry to help create this phony organization. And I just think that legislators have to be alerted to the fact that often these phony groups are created with names that sound legitimate, but they're simply funded by the chemical industry or the tobacco industry. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Any questions? Thanks again. Gordon Nelson. Gordon Nelson?
Yes.
Please state your name and affiliation, and thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity. I'm Gordon L. Nelson. I'm University Professor of Chemistry at Florida Institute of Technology. I have a long career in both academia and in industry, and so as I've been burning plastic items and working on flame retardants for about 30 years. So I've been interested in listening to the testimony, and unfortunately there's a lot of total information out there. First would like to comment upon the comment related to the EPA voluntary phase-outs. Those aren't proposed. Those are underway. They were executed with EPA on December 15th, 2009 by each of the three world's largest flame retardant suppliers. The agreement was that by December 31st, 2010, the sales of DECA would be phased out for electrical and electronic equipment, that by December 31st, 2012, all uses except transportation and military. So this is not proposed. It, in fact, is an agreement between the three major suppliers and EPA. And in the case of ICL Industries, since that's, well, they're all three international companies, but that, in fact, included phase-out of imports as well. So it's not just what's being manufactured in the U.S., but also their involvement in imports. So that, I think, is the first thing, and that is that these aren't proposed. They're a voluntary agreement, which is, in fact, underway. As you do know, but quickly I do want to say it, and that is that Penta BDE and Octa BDE haven't been manufactured since 2004. We've already mentioned about the phase-out, which is underway for DECA BDE. One of the things that the committee may wish to think about, and that is, and certainly in a couple of other states, looking at, if you will, codifying what the EPA agreement is. And there are two major differences between the Alaska bill and the EPA phase-out letters. First is that the phase-out letters include military uses, very specifically, because those can be large products and very difficult to find alternatives. The second is that the EPA agreements exempt products that are from recycling. That is, if you have post-consumer recycle that contain DECA BDE, that's in fact not affected. The sale of products made from recycled materials will also not be affected. So those are the two differences from the proposed bill and the EPA agreements. A lot has indeed been said here this afternoon about TVs, for example, and the last speaker. I actually, working with General Electric Company at the time back in the 1970s, burned some of the first televisions made with DECA BDE and polystyrene. And indeed, for DECA, the number one application has been in televisions, not in computers, but in fact in televisions. And I can tell you that in early 1970s, there were 200 fire deaths a year from televisions in the United States, 800 life-threatening fires, 20,000 fires from TV in the United States. When the UL requirement, CPSC, by the way, had declared televisions as then made to be of unreasonable risk. And so Underwriters Laboratories actually came forward with a voluntary standard, 1410, beating out the CPSC process for a mandatory standard. And the question I had from GE Television, as the first manager of combustibility technology for GE Plastics, was, does the requirements to go to flame-retardant plastics under the test UL94V0, is that going to make a difference? Well, we, got some TVs, first TVs made with DECA and polystyrene, and we tried to, we tested a television set as currently made at that time, and what we did is hot wire ignite the tuner bracket inside the set so you get an internal fire, and without flame retardants in three parts, the antenna bracket, the tuner bracket, and the enclosure, we had a life-threatening fire, a full room flashover fire from a single television set in a 10-by-10-foot room at 5 minutes into the test. We did the same thing with those three parts made from V0 polystyrene, flame retarded with DECA, and we couldn't ignite it. We tried very, very hard in a variety of ways to ignite it, and then we did an outside ignition with some small paper milk cartons in a plastic wastebasket. What happened with that is, in fact, the enclosure melted. It, again, did not ignite. So our recommendation to GE Television was, in fact, that when this goes into effect, there will no longer be 200 deaths a year from in the U.S. from TV. And that is, in fact, what has happened. So when people say that the use of flame retardants doesn't have a very substantial life safety record, they are simply, in fact, wrong. I think that is the first thing. One hears a lot of this 11 seconds. That's simply a test which has no relationship to risk from fire. I just gave you an example with televisions. I mean, the job of flame retardants is, in fact, to eliminate a lot of fires, to make some fires much smaller, and make other fires take a much longer time. And as one of you all said, well, if I had 11 seconds, I could get out of the house. And indeed, that is true as well. A comment was made about the CPSC proposals related to upholstered furniture using a smoldering test. CPSC has been trying, but with extensive furniture industry opposition, to get a national test for furniture for decades. The use, however, of a smoldering only test rather than open flame, as is included in California, belies the fact that 50% of fire deaths from upholstered furniture in the United States are from other than smoldering. They're other than cigarettes. That is, their open flame and electrical sources. So that's in the latest NFPA statistics from the last couple of years. So I think, first of all, is that the bill really, at this point in time, Penton and Okta don't exist. There's a very detailed process underway with EPA, which will lead to the phase out, which is already largely complete for DECA. I guess the one final thing I would say is related to the difficulty that the department's going to have in dealing with this whole issue of alternatives. There may well be alternatives, but does the product in the end, will it be able to serve the function? And that's not as easy as one may think. There are certainly hundreds of flame retardants in the marketplace, but they don't, not all flame retardants work in all systems. And that's why, for example, DECA is used in television and Penta was used in a polyurethane foam. An example of what I'm talking about is that DECA is used in sophisticated materials handling systems, what amount to plastic shipping pallets. But the problem ends up being is that the most promising alternative ends up with a pallet which is substantially heavier. That is, it's above 50 pounds. 50 pounds is the OSHA limit that a single person may lift under OSHA regulation. So, in fact, that alternative doesn't allow the product to be used. So the department will have grave difficulty in finding something, not only that the alternatives exist, whether they may or are safer in the environment, as a couple of speakers have said, is going to be more difficult because they've been less tested. So I think they're going to have a very difficult time in that regard. So I think it's a bill that I would urge you not to support. So with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Representative Holmes, followed by Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just a little confused. I thought I heard here that all three forms of the PBDs, the DECAs, and all of them are all going to be phased out under this EPA, and it's all going to solve the problem long before the effective date of this bill. So I don't understand why there's an objection to it. I guess that's a question.
Some more of a statement.
Well, there's.
If I could answer, and that is that. Penta and Okta aren't being made. DECA is part of a careful phase-out process. The bill doesn't exempt military applications, which is different from EPA, and it also doesn't deal with the issue of post-consumer recycled products, which are already out there and which would be permitted under EPA. So I think, you know, and I can fully understand why legislators might want to codify the EPA agreement, given that there's certainly some chemical suppliers from China, so forth. But the voluntary agreement has been very carefully crafted, and the exemptions are there, so forth. But it really, I guess I would submit, isn't particularly helpful to, and certainly won't do much to change the disappearance that's already underway for PBDEs.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you give me a little history on these chemicals? When did we first start using them?
I can tell you very specifically about DECA. DECA was invented by Dow. In fact, Dow, being up where it is, actually has bromine. It was very extensively tested by them at the time, and say that this was at a time when the whole TV issue was bursting onto the scene, and it turned out to be the perfect flame retardant for polystyrene. So the requirements for TV were basically July 1st, 1975 to be V2, V1 July 1st, 1977, and V0 July 1st, 1979. Basically, what TV manufacturers did is to do it July 1st, 1975. So DECA was invented in the very early 1970s and got heavily into the marketplace by 1975.
Thank you. And a follow-up, there's a line here, and it may make sense in a minute. How long was it after it started being used that the red flag started going up that there might be health hazards?
I would say probably 20 years.
So I guess my point is, if we introduce new chemicals or whatever that may in fact be flame retardant, are we waiting 20 years before we find out if they're safe?
Well, in fact, what's interesting about DECA, unlike Penta and Octa, Penta and Octa did not pass European risk assessment. DECA does. So DECA, in fact, is, and it was extensively tested by Dow back in 1970. So, I mean, truth be told, DECA, unlike Penta and Octa, is not a horrendously toxic chemical.
And I guess my point is, if we replace these with some of these other newfound or unnamed chemicals, are we going to be introducing something new in the environment that 20 years down the road may in fact be worse than what we've got now? I guess it's the devil you know versus the devil you don't.
Yeah, well, I kind of agree with that, although what I would say is that and certainly in Europe and in the U.S. as well, there's a lot more extensive toxicological environmental testing today than there was back 30 years ago. So I think we're going to understand things a whole lot better more quickly. And in fact, I might mention that a large number of flame retardant chemicals have already been extensively examined by risk assessment under REACH in Europe.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just don't want us to get in a situation where we put something forward as a replacement and it turns out to be, even if it's 5 years, not as effective and maybe more toxic. So those are my concerns with the direction that we're going. I think the phase out's the way to go, Mr. Chairman.
I agree with what he just said.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you. I just had one question. You said that the Penta and Octa are no longer being made, but then again you mentioned something about China and imports. So is it still being made? Is China still using Penta and Octa BDE?
China is not using Penta and Octa.
Okay, thank you. That clarified mine.
Representative Sadler, did you have a question? I've got one. How many, now that we've had it around for about 20 years, how many deaths a year are we averaging on DECA and Penta and Octa? Just roughly.
In terms of from toxicity?
Yeah.
To my knowledge, none.
So we know that it's hazardous, but we don't know what kind of impact it's having. It's not like we can
that if you. I mean, that's a really a very important question. We do know in the case of DECA for television alone how many people were saved each year. I have not seen any papers which are able to identify deaths from the toxicological properties of the material.
Because, I mean, we can say that we know that, you know, 500,000 smokers are going to die a year, 200,000, and we can ballpark it, but we can't on this, which I wonder if we're a bit premature in the direction we're going in. Any further questions for Mr. Nelson? We've got one more person online for questions. We've got Terry Bannister, who helped us with this. Anybody need to talk to Terry? You're off the hook, Terry.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for being there.
You're welcome.
Is there anybody else online? I think with that, we will close out the testimony. Anybody in the room? Close it out here. And just with once. That, I think, pardon me?
Just once.
just once? Not twice? No, I think we'll be giving the bill further review, and with that, we'll take a brief at ease. On the record, the last item we have on the calendar today is Senate Bill 119, a continuation of yesterday, and we have Christine back from the sponsor, Senator Meyer's office. And I think we all remember the bill from yesterday, but when we left yesterday, I had objected to the CS, which is version X, and at this time I'll remove my objection. Are there any further objections? Yeah, I think we have at least one amendment.
Representative Holmes. Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number one.
I'll object for purposes of discussion.
Wait, give me a second. I had it. I know I had it.
All right, ready?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This has to do with the Interscholastic Activities and Eligibility section. And what it does is it deletes language and then basically reinstates it because subsection 1, it breaks out a couple of different subsections here into a subsection A and a subsection B. What it does is, I'm going to tell a story, and this is going to be the best way to explain it. The bill as...
Long story or short story?
Short story. The bill as drafted would allow a student who's in an alternative education program that doesn't offer interscholastic activities to go to another school. So my personal history is that although I graduated from West High, I went to Stellar for a few years. And I played sports at Romig, and I played sports at West. So that would be coming from a school that didn't have interscholastic activities, going to a school that did. That's great. This bill in front of me would have been fine because it allows the student to go and play sports or do other activities at the school where they would otherwise be going to. That works great. That would have worked great for me up until I got to my junior year when I needed to take some math and science classes outside of Stellar. Well, West High inconveniently changed their schedule around so that they had this weird rotating schedule, which they had different classes on different days, that did not mesh with Stellar's schedule. So I couldn't take my math and science there, so I had to go to Diamond, which was the next closest school, in order to get my math and science classes. This bill would have required me to go to Stellar for most of my classes, drive partway across town to take my classes at Diamond, and then drive partway across town back to West to play sports. So I would have been taking classes at two schools and playing sports for a third. I don't think that's the intended result in this. So what this does is saying that the student has the option to do one of three things. They can go to the school for sports and other activities that's their local district school. That's subpart one on line eight. Subpart two is, alternatively, they could go to do these at a school where they are attending, enrolled to attend one or more classes, which would have covered my example of where I was taking classes at Diamond. Or third, the school that's closest geographically to the school where the student attends the alternative program. This would be, for instance, if a kid lived all the way down in South, and I'm going to continue to use Stellar as the example here. If the kid lives all the way down in South, they don't have a bus that will take them from Stellar to South, so I'm not entirely sure that they would be able to get there in time if South were their local school in order to be there in time for practice. But they might be able to get to West, which is really close to Stellar. So this would say, you know, plus you might have a bunch of kids from that school who can carpool together, and then maybe their parents can pick them up after their activities. So the third alternative is they could go to the school that's geographically closest to the alternative school. So I hope that explains what I'm trying to do. I'm just trying to make sure that we don't disenfranchise kids, because right now, under the rules, I was able to actually go take the classes at Diamond. I would hate to cut that alternatives out. I think the intent is to make sure kids can participate in after-school activities, and I would hate for us unwittingly to instead limit their options.
Representative Sattler, do you want her to repeat that?
Well, maybe a little dialogue through the chair, Representative Holmes. Interesting. So you're trying to make it so someone who's enrolled in a separate public school has a better option. I'm confused, actually. It sounds like kind of convoluted. I had read this earlier thinking that looking at, for example, paragraph 2, hadn't realized it was or, but enrolled in one more class. And so if a student who was enrolled in an alternative school that was actually not at a public school but was, for example, homeschool,
mm-hmm.
How would this affect that person? I think it would have required them to take one class at the public school at which they wanted to participate in interscholastic mm-hmm. activities. Looking at it that way, for your particular case that you just described, I understand one thing, but if it's someone who is at a home school, paragraph 2 would require them to take a class at that school.
Mr. Chairman, that's an or, not an and.
Yeah, that's an or, yeah. I have my notes around it, so.
One or two or three.
Yeah, one or two or three.
I agree that one and two and three would be unworkable.
Yeah, yeah.
They're intended to be, Mr. Chairman, if I may, one or two or three. It's intended to give a few more options so we don't unwittingly. I mean, I know that sports, in some cases it may be band, it may be orchestra, it may be drama club, it may be chess club, interscholastic activities. A lot of these smaller homeschoolers, for instance, you know, don't have any of these other options, and it may be really important for their socialization for them to be on some sort of be in some clubs or play some sports. For kids who choose to go to an alternative school that's small enough, or you know, maybe a private school or something that doesn't have these options, I'm just trying to make it as inclusive as possible so that we don't have children who say, for instance, you know, the best option for my child is to go to this particular type of program, but oh my gosh, if I send them there, we can't get them to the other school in time for sporting events.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to make sure I understand. So, and let you Stellar, and the high school next to that is
West.
So if I live in South Anchorage, and I go to Stellar, I have to go to West?
No.
I can go to the one closest to my home as well?
Correct.
Because there are those loyalties.
Absolutely. I am not, and by using that and being a West alum, I am not trying to send all the kids to West.
That's what I'm saying.
No. Trajan Langdon could continue to play basketball. Trajan Langdon, for instance, went to school at Stellar and played basketball for East. He could continue to play basketball for East. I could continue to play tennis for West. However, if I were then required to go down and take classes at Diamond, I could at least not have to go to three schools at the same time.
And, Mr. Chairman, you're not changing any of the definitions or any of that.
No.
We're,
Did you turn over and make sure nothing was deleted?
I'm not trying to pull a fast one, I promise.
Through the chair, more discussion and questions. So if I'm looking at this properly, because it's or this or that, the way the bill originally came to us, it was designed to make sure to prevent what I'm going to call school shopping. You know, someone wanting to play at the really good hockey team or his favorite band or his favorite football team or something like that. And this would allow him a couple different bites of the apple if the school he or she wanted to attend because of their activity was closest to their home, which is the original intent of this bill. Well and good. That's option under paragraph one.
Mm-hmm.
Paragraph two, it allows that person the option to say, well, if I take one class, I can go to some other school. And it actually doesn't limit it to within that same district even. You could go to West Valley High or Tantalo Valley or Colony if you wanted to play whatever. And it would additionally require taking an extra class. And if you're already taking a full load of classes, as provided elsewhere in the bill, that you'd have to be taking five classes if you're a freshman, sophomore, junior, four classes if you're a senior. This would require that person to take an additional class, you know, a more academic load. And incidentally, would require them to take a class in a public school, which is not the goal. And paragraph three is closest geographically to the school which the student attends the alternative educational program. If a student were living in, say, South Anchorage and was attending the IDEA program, that would kind of limit their scope unless they want to play basketball in Galena. But so,
well, that's why it's one or two
or three. But so,
I guess I
close with a comment. I'll make it a question since this is kind of Jeopardy. How many cases of your situation is somewhat unusual? I think. How many cases do you think this would apply to?
I think. Well, if you're asking this whole thing, I think it potentially applies to any student who is homeschooled or in an alternative program who chooses to play sports or activities. So it could be a lot. And like I said, it's one or two or three. And the intent is just to make sure that kids have the ability. The problem is the way it was drafted. I think there would be kids who wouldn't be able to get rides all the way across town. I just remember when I was taking math and science classes at West before they went to their rotating schedule. I was taking classes at West, math and science, and I was also playing sports. And that was really convenient because it's so close to Stellar that we could all carpool. I was not of driving age, but there was another kid who was taking classes at the same hours who was of driving age. So she could drive us back and forth. The kid might not have somebody who could drive them back and forth to other and this could be Polaris, and I don't know what the closest school would be, but that would be a different school to be closest. It's just an attempt to try to make sure that kids can get back and forth. I mean, we all know how important it is for kids to have, you know, sports and other activities. And this is just, I'm just trying to make sure that we don't have some poor kid who can't take part in after-school activities because they can't get the transportation. And that's the number three, is really a transportation issue. If the kid doesn't have transportation back to their home district in time, I'm just trying to make sure that maybe they can get to the closest school in time for the activity to start.
And for the record, all these high schools, Polaris and West, those are all in Anchorage school districts. So.
Yeah, and I'm sure there are. Oh, sorry. Yeah, for the record, I'm sure there are lots of, maybe private schools and homeschool programs all over the state that are similar. I'm just using the examples I know.
Okay,
Christine, did you have a comment? You looked like you did a few minutes ago. No. any further comments? And is there anybody?
My good friend struggling, Mr. Chairman.
No, I have some concerns about, and I come from a very competitive athletic area, and they were always trying to steal students out of a school to go to your school. So if you've got an outstanding athlete, and let's say they go to Grace Christian, and the coach is willing to pick them up and take them to class at any school, that's available under this scenario.
Stacking the team.
Because they'd be able to go to any school.
But doesn't Grace Christian have interscholastic activities? And so they wouldn't be eligible.
St. Mary's Cathedral, or the St. Mary's Catholic School.
Mm-hmm.
unintended consequence.
You know, I just see coaches, and I've lived in a town where the coach from another town would come in and offer your father a job to move to that town to play football. Uh-huh. So I come from an area that's not quite like we're dealing with.
I know, and so,
but I've seen some of the insidious things that happen when you open enrollment and stuff. So I've got concerns about that. And I also understand what this is trying to fix, a homeschool situation that I certainly am in agreement to, but I don't want to open it up to where you start having everyone want to go to West High because they have a fabulous tennis team. Or South.
In my day.
Or South because they have a fabulous football. Yeah. So I just want to avoid that kind of temptation because it's out there and there is a tremendous pressure to win. And if we put this kind of temptation, I'm just concerned, and I'm not sure it's not a great idea, Representative Holmes, but I've seen abuses. Unfortunately, I was never recruited by one of these coaches, so that's probably why I had the irritation. But I just don't want to open that possibility up. And I don't know if this does that or not, so I need to mull this over. I need to figure out a way I could scheme it. And then if I can do it, then someone else can. So.
And if I may, Mr. Chairman, I'm not telling you couldn't.
Right.
I'm not telling you couldn't. I'm just telling you that this would have excluded me from any activities my junior year because I needed to take math and science classes somewhere else, and I could no longer take them at my local school. And I would not have been able to get from Stellar to Diamond to West and around in circles when I was not yet of driving age. And I know that there were several people who had that problem.
Mr. Chairman, and maybe you've hit on the solution, if you need to take for your graduation classes that aren't in the school that you're attending and are forced to attend someplace else as a result of not having the academics available, because that's still got to be our priority as academics, then you would be able to do that. But as long as it was available to your school, you wouldn't have that choice.
So there's a friendly amendment.
I don't know, but I don't know how to do that.
I would consider.
Okay, considering the clock is running.
I've got some time.
I have a thought.
Yes.
If you would withdraw your amendment for the time being and you and Representative Johnson hammer out something tonight that is agreeable to you.
Absolutely.
And then email it to Christine or email it to Conrad and Conrad will get it out as.
Okay. Absolutely. Mr. Chairman, with that, I would like to withdraw amendment number one.
And with that, I'd like to open up public testimony. Is there anybody in the room that hasn't previously testified yesterday? Is there somebody in the room that hasn't testified?
I testified.
Come on up. You testified yesterday, didn't you?
Sorry.
Yeah. Is there anybody online? Seeing that, I think I'm going to close out testimony, public testimony at this point in time. And we're going to... We're going to work out the amendment tonight and work out a number of other issues that are still hanging out there. And part of the problem is this time of year we get bills that would typically take 2 to 3 weeks to do right, and we're trying to get them done in a day or two, and we've got at least 6 other bills that have similar issues. But with that, we'll be bringing the bill back tomorrow. I can't remember if we had it scheduled, but we do have BPH, so we can address it when we have some fixes. And with that, we'll adjourn at 5:05.
Oh, yeah.